Right, thank you very much. So I would like to share responsibility for what I'm gonna say with my collaborators over there with different things. So we'll be talking about quantum annealers. So maybe let me start by giving a very quick sketch, cartoonish sketch on quantum annealing. So what it is. So similarly to classical annealing, for example, simulated annealing or something like this, as a heuristic for finding global optimum of my objective function, I can view quantum annealing as an interpolation process where instead of interpolating in the temperature, I will be interpolating the objective. So I start with a certain objective function, which is easy to prepare, and I start in the ground state, and then the principle behind quantum annealing is that if I change this objective function slowly enough, and slowly enough relates to my system, then the adiabatic theorem guarantees that I should stay in the ground state. And if for some reason there is some noise, also I can, for probably decoherence, I can possibly exploit quantum tunneling to advance to the global minimum. So, for example, if we would like to use quantum annealing for finding the ground state of an Ising model, then typically what we do is that we consider this Hamiltonian, which is a combination of initial Hamiltonian, which is easy to prepare, and my target Hamiltonian. So, for example, if I'm interested in finding the ground states of Ising model, I can take this as my target Hamiltonian. I can take the transverse field superposition as a initial Hamiltonian, and then I can interpolate between the two using some monotonic functions. So, what is the goal of that? Finding ground states of an Ising model corresponds to, in optimization, corresponds to finding solution to the so-called CUBA problem, so quadratic unconstrained binary optimization problem. So it's a quadratic program on binary variables. So essentially the input to this problem is given by the couplings between the variables and the priors, so or local fields, and the output is essentially given the optimal configurations, the configuration with the minimum energy. Since I mentioned that if we decide to physically implement quantum annealing due to noise and incoherence of the system, what might happen is that every time that I'm doing quantum annealing, I will not get exactly the ground state, but I can get into excited states. So essentially, I will produce some, I will do some sampling process from a certain distribution. And that's why quantum annealing has been recently, in recent years, have been viewed also as an interesting approach to the Boltzmann sampling problem. So for example, maybe we could use quantum annealing to sample from the Boltzmann probability distribution that corresponds to a certain Ising model, where again, this distribution is parameterized by the couplings and local fields, and the output is IED samples with respect to the distribution. So the most famous implementation of quantum annealing nowadays is the D-Wave quantum annealer. I started to work on it because actually Los Alamos National Lab bought one of these machines. It was a very expensive machine. And essentially, it was a very good application for the methods we were working on that I'll describe in what follows. But essentially, these are the characteristics of the machine that that Los Alamos have bought. By the way, it has been recently upgraded. But this was an older version. So essentially, we were talking about like 1,000 qubits. About 3,000 couplers. So this machine is a machine based on superconductors, Josephson junctions, and so it operates at a very low temperature, and essentially it represents a very big refrigerator and with a very small chip inside. It has some programmable features such as different J's that you can input, different H's, and different annealing times. you cannot input an arbitrary program into this machine. You can, so essentially the topology of your model is restricted by this graph, which is called chimera graph. So this is the, I believe, the picture of our of the previous DDUF2X that we had at Los Alamos. And essentially the dots represent the spins and the lines represent the couplings. And if I zoom, so it is composed of individual cells where each individual cell represents a bipartite graph from 8 qubits, where there are connections drawn between 4 qubits on the left and 4 qubits on the right. And these cells are interconnected with the neighboring cells horizontally and vertically in the manner which is represented here. So this is the picture of 4 cells. So yeah, as I said, so D-Wave essentially is can be viewed as a black box and a very sophisticated analog device. And so essentially we would like to understand what it is doing. And we'll try to do this in this talk using the statistical learning methods. So let me first explain how do you program the D-Wave. So essentially, as I said, so you have the input to the machine, which are numerical values that you communicate to the machine via an interface. It gets implemented into the machine through the digital to analog converter. So this process is not, obviously is not ideal in a sense that what is implemented typically differs from what you input. There can be some rescaling. There are obviously some biases, some noises. There is like finite discretizations due to the implementation. But essentially, then D-Wave, you can ask D-Wave to run several annealing runs, and then it outputs a certain number of spin configurations. So we can ask several questions. The first question is, can we essentially characterize the probability distribution which D-Wave outputs? And question two is, from this knowledge of this probability distribution, can we learn something useful about how the machine operates? So let me first stop on how you solve, let's say, the first question. Maybe at this point I would like to mention that in contrast to several talks that we heard before, here I'm not searching for just describing this probability distribution maybe in some implicit form. I would like to really learn the interaction between the variables so that later on I could relate it to something that happens in the machine. So in order to learn the distribution on binary samples, we'll use a state-of-the-art method for doing that, for solving this inverse problem, which is called interaction screening. So let me first pose the problem. So mathematically, we have a bunch of random spin configurations, independent, identically distributed, with respect to this probability distribution. So any probability distribution on binary samples, I can write it in a positive probability distribution. I can write it in a form of a Boltzmann distribution with the energy function that I can, for example, expand in this way. So where I have first order, and then second, third order, fourth order interactions, etc. So the first term is essentially corresponds to biases or priors, parameterized by local fields, and then I have multi-body interactions, which essentially describe me the conditional probabilities that exist in this graphical model. So there is a famous problem, which is called inverse Ising problem, which essentially asks you to reconstruct the structure and parameters of the Ising model given ID samples, and usually we're talking about first and second order term. Here, in this formulation, it's a generalization of this problem, essentially inverse graphical model problem, so we would like to potentially be able to reconstruct all orders in this probability distribution. So how do you solve? So the reason why we want to do this is because the samples, the binary samples that are output by D-Wave, nobody guarantees that these are coming from an Ising model. These are some distributions, so again, we would like to keep some generality. So the method is a subject of a separate talk, so let me just briefly mention mention how it works. Essentially, you can design a so-called generalized RISE. RISE stands for Regularized Interaction Screen Estimator, which is a local estimator for each node, a convex function, which takes this form. It's essentially just the empirical expectation with respect to your samples of an exponential of minus terms that are attached to spin sigma I. So notice that I define my Boltzmann distribution with a sign plus, and I absorb low temperature inside the couplings. And the interaction screening takes actually the same expression only for terms that contain sigma I, so potentially all terms, because I don't know what are the interactions, with the opposite sign. And I would like to, so this is a sum of exponentials when I take expectations over my samples. So this is a sum of convex function, it's a convex function. And I would like to find the minimum of this function. This will correspond to my estimates for all these parameters. One can rigorously analyze this estimator and show that this estimator is exact in a sense that you can guarantee that given a certain number of samples, you can guarantee the error that you will do on the parameters estimated and show that it decays. It is tractable and parallelizable because, for example, for ISO, for multi-body interactions, it take n to the power l algorithmic complexity, where l is the maximum interaction order that you consider. So, for example, for Ising model, it's order n squared log n algorithmic complexity. And it can be run in parallel for every node. Essentially, it works for arbitrary discrete graphical models. Here, I present just a particular case for this study, but essentially, we don't have to consider parameterization in terms of monomial. This can be arbitrary functions. And by the way, parameters, the variables don't have to be binary. They can be discrete. But in this work, we're going to deal with binary variables, so that's why I present this. So most importantly, I guess, for the study that will for what follows, is that this method is exact for all graphical models. So in particular, if we're talking about Ising models, it also works for models at low temperature, for spin glass models, for dense models, et cetera, et cetera. And again, for example, for Ising model, if you do the sample analysis of this algorithm, you can show that it requires the number of samples, which is nearly close to information theoretical bound. It means that it requires the minimum amount of samples that you that IT bound tells you to use. So yeah, so essentially, I'm not going to talk about the details of this algorithm, so any proofs. But you can find some details in this paper for Ising models and for discrete graphical models in this paper. So here I just like do I just wanted to make a quick illustration on what it means. Essentially, we can consider different for Ising model. For example, we can run synthetic experiments, generate IED samples with respect to this model, and then look empirically using this algorithm, what is the number of samples that is required to provably reconstruct the corresponding model. And if you look at the scalings for high beta, so in low temperature regime, you can show that it is always below exponential 4 beta d, which is essentially the upper bound on the IT optimality. So, and here, just a quick illustration on the value of using exact algorithms, especially for this study, compared to some heuristics. So, for example, one popular heuristic that was used for many years, for example, some mean field methods that are known to fail at low temperature. So here I give a quick example of one instance of this portion of the chip where we were drawing samples on D-Wave. And for example, for this particular instance, you can show that essentially this corresponds to a very low temperature model, and mean field cannot reconstruct the structure, but this method is exact. So given a certain sufficient amount of samples, it perfectly recovers the structure. So let us go back to studying the D-Wave. So I just described the method that we're going to use. And essentially, we'll use this method for solving question one, so characterizing the probability distribution that is output by D-Wave for any instance that we'll be interested in. Now the question is, given this procedure, so what can we learn about the machine? So in particular, we'll be interested in understanding what is the type of interactions that we can find in this probability distribution, what is the structure of these interactions, and most importantly, can we describe what is the relation between this probability distribution, which is output, and the input? So for example, if we think that D-Wave acts as a Boltzmann sampler and it samples from an Ising model, this is very good because, for example, there are a lot of applications, in particular in machine learning, where we would like to have such a sampler, which is believed to be an NP-hard problem in general, unless it violates some strong conjectures in approximation theory. So we would like to have some, maybe use D-Wave as a machine that could accelerate this process, but we would like to, but we need, for this, we need to understand what is the relation between the model that we specify and essentially the model that we get in the end. So can we essentially infer this input-output relation and characterize it? So let me start with this. So now we have this agenda. So let me start first with the first item, which was what kind of, as I said, we have this binary samples which are output from a D-Wave. Nobody told us that this is an Ising model in the first place. So what are the type of interactions that we can find there? So let me remind you, so my probability distribution, if I write it in this form, so these first two order correspond to the Ising model, and maybe they have some relations, this parameter, maybe they have some relations to the parameters that are input to the machine, but maybe in the end, I also get some multibody interactions. So in order to check that, so we run the first experiment on a single cell of 8 spin. We set input couplers, in this example, to a small ferromagnetic value, and we don't set magnetic fields. And this is the outcome of the algorithm. When we run reconstructions with sufficient number of samples, which in this case, it corresponds to pretty low temperature, so these are several million samples. Essentially, what we get is, so here we plot different histograms. We go to the, let's say, up to the four-body terms, and these are the log histograms for the couplings inferred for the two-body terms, three-body terms, four-body terms, etc. So the strongest interactions that you infer, they indeed correspond to the Ising model that we have input. So essentially, these are native chimera couplings. However, the next strongest interactions that you infer are some couplings that do not exist in the machine. So these do not exist in the topology, and we never input them. And for example, for this ferromagnetic case, essentially we get this kind of links, which are reconstructed interactions. So already this isn't a surprise. In principle, moreover, we can demonstrate that actually there exist multibody interactions in there, although they're smaller. So for example, here I just put a very generous threshold, which is 3 sigma. Essentially what we've done is that since this is a small system, I could just replicate the system and do synthetic simulations on the side and do a lot of reconstructions and quantify what is the number of samples empirically that I need in order to guarantee a certain precision on the couplings. And here I plot the 3 sigma for which kind of cut down couplings that I might deem insufficient, but there are still, for example, this 44 body term which pops up. So there are multibody interactions. One of the motivations, by the way, for checking if there are multibody interactions was that maybe if you remember, in the chimera topology, there are actually some holes like this. So these holes correspond to broken qubits. that do not function for some reason, and the decision made by D-Wave was not to deactivate these qubits, but essentially just to leave it in there. But they might still have some residual values that connects them to other qubits. And essentially, when you look at the probability distributions that corresponds to visible units in the presence of these hidden units, this can give rise, even if the original model is Ising, can give rise to a higher order model. However, we don't know what is the nature of this interaction, but we still find them, but they are pretty small. So in what follows, we'll ignore them. And indeed, so this result essentially shows that the D-Wave acts as a Boltzmann sampler with some Ising model, which we already saw that it's different from the one that you input because there are the spurious couplings. And so let us try to understand better what is the structure of these pair interactions and what is the nature of those. So once again, if we now limit ourselves to the two-body terms, and we consider four chimera cells in this ferromagnetic setting, then what happens is that indeed, so you recover the strongest couplings, as I said, correspond to the native chimera couplings, but you also get those spurious couplings. Now, the interesting thing is that, for example, for this ferromagnetic model, the sign of these spurious interactions that we find is the opposite one. So it's actually some anti-ferromagnetic interactions. We have run this experiment, I'm not going to show the plots, but we have run the experiment for many other systems. For example, anti-ferromagnetic. If I input anti-ferromagnetic couplings, I find, again, anti-ferromagnetic interactions. If I use some spin glass type configurations, then these interactions can have random sign. So something to keep in mind. And that's exactly what I said. So most significant interactions corresponds to kind of the topology of your problem, but then there are some weaker spurious interactions, but which are non-negligible. And let's try to understand where those are coming from. So in order to do this, let us attack kind of the last question on the agenda, which is, can we characterize the input-output relations between the input couplings that characterize my problem and the couplings that characterize the output distribution? So again, we're in this setting where I assume that I've already solved the inverse problem, and so I characterize my output coupling in terms of J out and biases H out. So it's not a secret. There has been, I'm not going to give an extensive literature review, but there have been many studies that were showing that essentially, indeed, this probability distribution, the output one, probably corresponds to some rescaled version of your original Ising model. So essentially, there is some effective scaling factor, beta effective, related to effective temperature of the device, which relates H out to H in. So in order to kind of check this hypothesis, we can consider a more general linear response function. For example, to say that I have my in couplings and I have my out couplings, and let me just look the most general linear function that relates the two and try to learn those matrices and to see what happens. So if, for example, indeed my model in the end just corresponds to some effective rescaling of my initial parameters, then what I should find is just a diagonal matrix with this number of the diagonal here and some zero offset. On the other hand, we have already seen that actually what we find in the end is some Ising model with additional couplings. There are also the spurious couplings that now we have to include. So, and when we include those, so we have tried the linear response, and essentially what we see is that depending on the case that you see, this gives two different answers. So essentially, this is an indication the linear response is not enough. So we have done something more general. So we went to the level of quadratic response. So essentially, trying to find the most general quadratic form, which relates me the output coupling to the input couplings. So here I have some response matrix that is potentially quadratic. I have the previous linear term. Again, if there is just the rescaling, that what I should find is that this matrix should be zero, this matrix should be diagonal, and I should have zero offset. So let's see what happens. So here in this experiment, we collected really a lot of data. The reason for that is that, as I said, we work at pretty low temperatures. So already, because of that, you need millions of samples just to perform one reconstruction, essentially to solve, to characterize one probability distribution corresponding to a single unit. But now we want to essentially find, to learn this general quadratic form. So essentially what we're doing is that we are taking a particular solution and then taking neighboring perturbations around these solutions, which can be pretty large. And so we consider for each instance of our problem, we collect samples, we do reconstruction, we repeat again, and then we can do a quadratic regression to essentially infer this function. So here in this example, we were doing 250 perturbations of this value, native value, around the zero problem. And this corresponds to all types of models. So ferromagnetic, anti-ferromagnetic, spin glass type, et cetera, et cetera. So in the total, we have around 1 billion samples. And we are working on this system. So essentially, now here is the essential terms that appear in this quadratic response function that we found. So indeed, we find that if we look at the relation of the output local fields to the input local fields, essentially this is like linear response. And this corresponds to essentially some diagonal terms with some effective temperature, which is slightly heterogeneous. So it means that for each qubit there is its own effective temperature. And indeed the H out is essentially related to the value of H in with the corresponding multiplier. And more or less the same thing happened for the native chimera couplings. So the J out essentially corresponds to some J in times a certain number, which is again heterogeneous. And the quadratic response is zero for those. However, if you look at the at the spurious links, we find that the linear response is zero. However, there is non-zero quadratic response. So what does it mean? It means that essentially each of the spurious coupling, J out, is given by a certain number times the product of the values of the J ins that I input over here in such a way that that those input couplings correspond to a triangle built on this output spurious link. So essentially there is, so these spurious links for some reason they appear as a quadratic response to the input couplings. And then in particular we see that the values that we measure are actually negative, so it means that if I have indeed like ferromagnetic model, I have a positive number here, but the total J out is negative, is antiferromagnetic. And the same things, if I have two ferromagnetic interactions, it also is negative, and if I have spin glass, random sign couplings, then I might have whatever works. And moreover, in our previous system, we looked at this quadratic response was asymmetric between both sides. So there was one side which was reacting much heavier to the input than the other. So what is the mechanism actually? Can we try to explain the appearance of this spurious interactions? So what are they due for? So one observation is actually which led us to a possible explanation was the observation that actually there, if you do reconstructions over several hours and you do reconstructions of the couplings which are native to chimera, the spurious one and the local fields by doing this parameter estimation, you find that while even for the zero Hamiltonian problem, even though you find that the value of the couplings stay constant, the magnetic fields fluctuate quite a bit. So essentially, over time, the value of magnetic fields appear to be very heavily fluctuating. And this led us actually to, so essentially what does it mean? It means that the samples that we accumulate in our reconstructions, they are not coming from a single Ising model in some sense. What is happening is, and this is very, very interesting, so the samplings that we accumulate is essentially coming from a mixture of different models where this magnetic field is fluctuating. And by the way, this is a very common situation. So when we solve like this kind of model selection problem in general and we apply it to real data, I think this is something to think about. Is that, for example, if we think that some data is related to some, let's say, biological system, there is no reason to believe that it corresponds to one unique model, right? So essentially, in reality, things are moving. So essentially, what we're getting is samples from a mixture of models with fluctuating parameters. And so essentially, this is what is happening here. So if you look at this very simple toy example, let me look at this Ising model where I have three qubits and I have interactions between these two and these two. And then I'm collecting samples from this graphical model where at every time the realization of the magnetic field is random. It's like plus minus xi, some value. I collect these samples, and then when I solve the inverse problem will find me one graphical model from which those samples came from. And so statistically, this is indistinguishable. And the samples are coming from, for example, you can show that in this case, you can show that it is absolutely impossible without any prior knowledge to say whether the samples came from a mixture of these noisy models or from a single model where I don't have any magnetic fields, but I have, let's say, antiferromagnetic interactions over here. And essentially, for example, you can brute force this toy example to show that if I have this kind of scenario, then the spurious links, you can exactly compute what it is, and it is given by this expression. So in the limit where the noise and couplings are small, it is proportional to the fourth power of the oscillations in magnetic field that I have over here. And you can do the same exercise if you have, let's say, model here of Gaussian fluctuating magnetic field. You can show that it's proportional. Essentially, you will get a spurious link, which is proportional to the minus and fourth power of the standard deviation of your field fluctuations. So this is actually good news because, first of all, this gives a mechanism for explaining what we're seeing, is that if there exist fluctuations in magnetic field, which is due to something, maybe to some noise, is that we'll see these systematic spurious links. But the good news is that it's a fourth power. So if I reduce these fluctuations by a certain factor, then I significantly reduce the value of the spurious link. So we were trying, we decided to kind of try to measure these fluctuations and to see whether they can quantitatively explain the values of the spurious links that we have discovered. And one approach to do this is essentially to collect some samples, for example, 10,000 samples over a certain time, perform reconstruction, and infer what is the value of the magnetic field at this time. So if you do this, you will get a certain standard deviation for the fluctuations of magnetic field. However, this is not enough because, like, I had to do this learning part. I had to collect some samples, so I had to take these 10,000 samples, but the field could have fluctuated, you know, around during that time. And so what I essentially see again is the average model. So what really matters for us is the instantaneous fluctuations on the order of one sample. So we designed a statistical method that, so I'm not going to present the results here, for reconstructing the fluctuations on a single sample scale. But essentially I can give you the idea of how that works, is that actually in D-Wave we have this luxury possibility of actually ordering the samples, so tracking the order at which the different samples arrive. So this allows us to compute the time correlations between different samples, and I can leverage that to extrapolate and to find the fluctuations of the field essentially at the single sample level. If we do this, actually what we find is that the fluctuations are much, much larger. So the fluctuations at the level of individual qubits corresponds to again to a certain standard deviation, which is pretty large. And this induces us the value of this quadratic response, which is equal to minus 3.5, which qualitatively agrees with what we have measured in the quadratic response. At this point, I would like to say that there can be other mechanisms actually that can contribute to this quadratic response. So, but this is what we found like as one of the best possible explanations for the most dominant effect. Okay, let me summarize. So in this study, we used essentially we showed that D-Wave indeed acts as a Boltzmann sampler with a probability distribution which is well described by a pairwise Ising model, which is, however, not exactly the same one as the one that you input in the machine. So this structure is approximately chimera, but with the spurious interactions, and we believe that this is coming from the fluctuations in the magnetic field. The input-output response, actually, we have looked at this carefully, and it looks like the quadratic response describes well the relationship between input and the output in like most of the interesting programmable ranges for sampling sampling purposes. And so this study actually here we really treated D-Wave as a black box. So it is important to know that this is a general methodology based on this kind of inverse graphical model learning. And this is extendable to other analog computing devices. So for example, you can replace D-Wave in this study by other analog machines that produce you binary samples. So for example, there are very interesting experimental realizations of Ising models that appeared in recent years. For example, the optic parametric oscillators based on photons interactions, et cetera, et cetera. So you can use the same study to understand kind of the input-output relations and to quantify the behavior of your analog system. So a couple of future directions that we started to explore are the follows. So the first question is, imagine that I'm a user and I would like to sample from a certain complex probability distribution, which is parameterized, let's say, by my Ising model. So can I invert this input-output relation somehow to understand what is the model that I should input, so essentially to perform a calibration. What is the model that I should input to get samples from my desired probability distribution? And we saw that because of this quadratic form, it's not that easy because you will create spurious couplings. But there are some possibilities. For example, maybe we can inject some noise, or maybe we can do something else. So D-Wave is moving actually towards topologies which are much less trivial than the chimera one. So there have been a lot of debates about chimera topology, whether you can indeed program a complicated, truly complicated problem there. So D-Wave is moving to a new architecture where for sure this will be possible. So it will be very interesting to see to which extent D-Wave will act as a Boltzmann sampler from the distribution as well. So another, in connection with the previous talk, actually an interesting question, so we're still trying to find the near-term applications on D-Wave, the killer applications. And we actually have tried to play with this, and we find a promising direction, which is actually application to robust optimization. The idea is that now that we know that there is some noise in the system, and essentially I'm producing samples, and if I use this machine as an optimizer, essentially what happens is that every time I'm producing an approximate solution from a different model with a different type of parameters. So essentially I can use this fact to try to build schemes with hardware in the loop, so hybrid algorithms, where D-Wave is used for facilitating stochastic optimization. And the first results that we obtain are pretty promising. And finally, it's very interesting that during quantum annealing, there is also this transverse field, and we observe that actually there can be fluctuations in there as well. So the idea is actually if you can also play with this. So this will require learning of quantum Hamiltonians and essentially understanding the effect of the noise on the final distribution. And so finally, one application is, in the context of what I mentioned, is that the framework applies to any analog black box analog device. So essentially, we are now trying to play a little bit with this emerging memristive technology, which again allows you to construct networks which produce some binary samples and some promising ideas for designing samplers for binary distributions. And we try to apply the same framework for essentially guiding the architecture of such networks. All right, thank you very much.
Questions? Comments?
So, do I understand correctly that you do this at fixed and total annealing time?
So we have so there is a lot of degrees of freedom in this machine. In particular, you can start to change the annealing time. What we found was that maybe if you noticed every time, because of this huge scaling factor, which is of order of 12 or something like this, which is corresponds to the output distribution, the input values that we were taking are pretty small. Which are really very small compared to the programmable range, because you can, for example, go for couplings all the way until 2, and for magnetic fields all the way until 1, which will correspond to effective temperature of 12, which essentially means that almost all configurations for ferromagnetic models that you'll get will always be +1 or -1. Why I'm telling this is because actually we found that the impact of these annealing times was much more pronounced and severe in the programmable range, which is close to this optimization regime, when you program J's and H's close to their boundaries, and much less pronounced here. So essentially, at some point, we're playing with annealing time, and then we got stuck with the minimum one, which was the best for collecting the huge amounts of samples.
Yeah, no, the reason I'm asking, because I would be interested in understanding it, if at some point you see actual quantum effects in all of this, right? Meaning that, do you see long-range interaction or long-range classical interactions among effective classical interactions among these puddles or not?
This is an excellent question. So actually, we do. So first of all, our first study before doing all of that was essentially to make sure on a single qubit on very small systems to make sure that we are in the regime where we're in the classical. We don't need to feed quantum distributions. So actually, for example, we tested the statistics corresponds to classical distributions, and we are not there. So we are in the classical world here. Again, keeping in mind that this may be an application for classical sampling subroutine. Yeah. Now, actually, we found, and that's something that I found in the end, we didn't conduct a very thorough study, but we found that, for example, there are fluctuations in the transverse field that exist. And actually, they lead to also quadratic response in the end, with an opposite sign, so which are canceling. So essentially, we even have an idea of the point, which corresponds to something like 0.3 in the input on the couplings, where actually those two effects should cancel. So essentially, you should not see spurious links, because they will be canceled exactly from this classical effect, because you have a mixture of distribution in Z component, and the quantum effect, because you have fluctuations in X. So this is another piece of information.
Typically, before simulating, let's say, annealing glass Hamiltonian on the D-Wave machine, on the chimera graph, you have to do embedding. So did you check the effect of embedding on the spurious coupling?
Yes, this is an excellent question. So if you want to input a really non-trivial instance on this chimera graph, you have to create this so-called logical qubits. Logical qubit essentially means that I have to essentially somehow say that I will put a very strong coupling between, let's say, two variables over here, something like equal to essentially to the saturation of the bound, and then hope that essentially these two variables will always take the same value so that I can declare that those two are the same. And then I can use essentially this to embed a non-complicated problem. However, for our purposes, if we do that, essentially this means that because of this huge multiplication factor of order 12, it means that essentially even for resolving and making sure, taking accurately into account this strong couplings in the logical inside logical qubits, we'll have to go to trillions or I don't know, astronomical number of samples to perform this learning problem. So that's why we were staying at the essentially. So here we were just kind of trying to understand the model of the D-wave, what D-wave is doing. So. I mean, so in this case, yes. Yeah, so we were just considering some input models that correspond to some instances that you can naturally embed on Chimera graph. Yeah. So the next step will be, it's very interesting, is to say, okay, now if I want to use this and to apply this to a certain particular problem, is it true that, for example, this quadratic response extends to this range as well? This needs to be checked, et cetera, et cetera.
So. I have a question related to kind of you're saying that this is finding this fictitious couplers were surprising. I think for me it's actually very natural why you should see them. So I have a different explanation maybe then. Correct me if I'm wrong. I would think if you want to do this first, there are two issues. One issue would be that there is a lot of degeneracy. So basically you are doing with this inverse spin-glass problem, you are doing a Hamiltonian estimation. Basically estimating, given some property distribution, you want to know what is the Hamiltonian generating it. And there is a large number of degeneracy in the Hamiltonian space that leads to the same distribution. This is usually, it is not necessarily that you get a unique kind of identification. That's generally true. But here in this case, once you sample from these states and they are not really low energy states of the actual Ising model that you program, the excited state might be related to some non-local k-local interaction, low energy states of a different Hamiltonian. So what I'm saying, this is in short range spin glasses, this is kind of well known. So you get this kind of larger droplet formation where you can get this kind of very large correlation on the order of input. So it can go on the order of n over 2, n over 4. And then I would think if you're sampling from those, so you would basically, with almost any statistical learning techniques, you're going to come across some k-local interaction because during the drive, when you add the fluctuation, quantum fluctuation, you can get this many-body localization and just get trapped in this one of these excited states, and like it corresponds to low energy states of a different Hamiltonian.
This is a very good question because it allows me to kind of come back on why I was insisting so much when I was describing the method that we're using, why I was insisting so much on saying that this is exact for constructing, et cetera, et cetera. So what does it mean exact? So let me come back to this. Essentially, it means that if I have a sufficient number of samples, and I can quantify what sufficient means, there is essentially a theorem that you can prove that you reconstruct uniquely the model, that there exists only unique model where these samples are coming from. So there is absolutely no, so there is degeneracy, there can be degeneracy on, for example, ground state values or something like this. But when I perform the sampling, I also sample the excited states. And actually, given a sufficient statistics of those, I can guarantee you the error on those on the couplings that I reconstruct. And in particular, I can guarantee you that if I reconstruct a fourth body interaction, it is there. It cannot be explained by the, for example, two body interactions. Although four body interactions can be associated with statistics, let's say correlations of four spins, and those can be explained by pairwise interactions. If I reconstruct a four body interaction, that means there is something in there which makes it non-Ising model. So essentially in this case, We can talk about details.
My problem is that if you do for any finite sampling, if it is the reshuffle, basically you're not like you do some Boltzmann sampling or Gibbs sampling. If you are not truly sampling from the bandwidths that you want, no matter how wide it is, you are gonna identify a different Hamiltonian. Because what I'm saying is that the machine is not going to give you faithfully the low energy states of its own Hamiltonian.
So that's the advantage of being completely agnostic. So what I essentially see is that I actually forget about all the physics. Although I know that this is coming from D-Wave and there are some considerations, I probably know where those samples are coming from, what was the process, etc. I deliberately forget about this, and the essentially the problem that I'm treating is a simple computer science problem, is that I'm given samples that I consider to be independent, and I'm asking the question, what is the probability distribution to which it corresponds to? For example, if I would like to use the D-Wave later to sample from my distribution, this is exactly what I'm going to do. So I'll try to program a certain model and to get independent samples from this model. So once, when I solve this problem, so I really characterize what is the probability distribution that describes me what's going on outside. And then I agree that there are several possible explanations for why you see something like, for example, spurious links or something like this. So there are several effects that can lead to this. Or multi-body interactions. I didn't even mention what are the possible reasons, but some of them can be related to annealing. But essentially, this study essentially just tells you that there is, you can essentially just view what these interactions are by solving this inverse problem.
Just the last comment is that I would think if you want to, that's pretty clever to try to say, I don't care the internal dynamics, I just like, this is the output it generates, and that's kind of the model that corresponds
yes,
to that output.
Absolutely.
But I think the variation, because of the D-wave noises and like various different kind of localization effect there, because it's a, you know,
but
it's
that's
not a classical
machine. There, they're in the samples.
It's no, but what I'm saying is that once you change, if you want to use it for a different thing, to basically use it as black box, I think the variations are, it's very hard to predict the distribution that it generates over a different problem class.
Well, that's what we're trying to do with our input-output response. So essentially, that's exactly what we're doing. We're sampling a large number of models, which are very different, around zero, with a certain maximum variation of the couplings. And what we found is that actually you can predict this function. So essentially, you're really predicting the behavior. Depending on the input, we found that in these range of values, so for example, those, you find that the response is quadratic, meaning that I can predict you precisely what will the distribution look like, the output distribution based on the input values. I'm not saying that this model will be valid outside of this range. However, this is kind of the range which kind of almost the limit of what can be useful for sampling reasons. If you input something more than this, this essentially corresponds to very extremely low temperatures. So, but in this range, which corresponds to temperatures like high temperatures, critical temperatures, moderately low temperatures, the response is quadratic. And I can give you more details during the break.
In any case, so maybe like if you come next week, we talk about anything on Chimera, we can sample it efficiently.
I'm not arguing with this.
Yeah.
So this is a baby study on Chimera graph, where, for example, there have been a lot of debates on whether Chimera, you can really solve hard problems with this, and probably no. So the next interesting step that I mentioned in the end will be if D-Wave moves to an architecture where you can input real non-trivial, for example, spin glass-like problems, it would be really interesting to see whether it will still act as a noisy Boltzmann sampler.
I have two questions. The first one is that, did you try to feed the modified Hamiltonian back into the system and see what happened? You got a different Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Because of the input-output relationship. So what happens when you try to feed that Hamiltonian back into the system?
So the thing is that the output Hamiltonian is the input multiplied by this large number, which is 12. So if I start, like, if I input this output Hamiltonian back, it will correspond to models that essentially in the optimization regime. It will, again, get multiplied by 12, which essentially means that it's like a very, very, yeah. So from the calibration perspective, something similar to, so essentially you would essentially what you would like to do is somehow to invert this relation, to understand, to solve the inverse problem, to say, given my target Hamiltonian, what is the input Hamiltonian I should input to exactly match it or closely approximate this one?
So this might help them to recalibrate their system.
Yes, exactly. This is a very interesting application, and but because of the appearance, systematic appearance of these spurious links, as I showed, because you sample from this mixture of models, I think this kind of efficient calibration scheme will involve, for example, deliberately injecting some noise or something like this. So we were in discussion with D-Wave folks about that, and that's certainly a very interesting project.
The second question is, they do have this reverse annealing facility in D-Wave. Did you try to sample from that? They have a reverse annealing feature.
This is absolutely amazing feature. So we didn't have access to this technology, actually. Our chip was too old. Now that it has been upgraded and we are collaborating with D-Wave, we would like to try this. And I predict that it's going to be very useful for learning quantum Hamiltonians. So something that I say, so essentially when you can come back and really control and stop the annealing process, it would be really interesting to see what happens with the quantum Hamiltonian during the annealing process and not just the classical output in the end.
More of a basic question. Here you show four sides. So you mentioned four couplers and four fields. Does that mean that you set everything else in your chimera graph equal to zero?
Yes.
So if the answer is yes, could it be that the extra terms you get are because of the errors that you have in those zeros? Because you mentioned at some point that there's some fluctuations in these couplings. So you have like over a thousand of those that you think are zero, but in reality they're not.
Yeah, this is an excellent question. So actually, our very first experiment with D-Wave was essentially to try to understand this and how we so this bias term, essentially the constant term. How do we do this? Essentially, if you input the zero Hamiltonian problem, in principle, you should get zero. Right? If you don't get zero, it means that essentially there are some, so all these multiplications terms are irrelevant because you're multiplying zero, but you will essentially get access to this term. And we indeed, and this corresponds to intrinsic biases that exist in the machine. So for example, I try to input zero, but I get some value which is close to it, but which is minus or plus something. We found that this term is not exactly zero, but it is actually pretty small. And when you work in the regime, when you input couplings which are not exactly zero, and then they get again multiplied by these huge factors, we find that actually the contribution coming from the zero terms are negligible. However, again, this was our first motivation to even to look at the multibody interactions. Let me maybe just give a very quick example. If I'm looking at the Ising model, which is consistent of four spins, but I'm producing IED samples from this model, but then an adversary hides me, let's say, the value of this spin. Okay? So what I only have access to is the statistics of this three spin. The model that I will reconstruct will actually look something like this. So it will look like a model, an Ising model, which is with additionally a three-body interaction here, potentially, which is non-zero. And it will perfectly describe me the statistics of my variables. But essentially, this model has nothing to do compared to that one. So when we saw these broken chips, our first idea was that there might be some multibody interactions that would arise just because of this effect, because there are some hidden units out there that I don't see. But however, because of this, like these biases are pretty small, and so essentially we found that there is no evidence. So essentially, when we run experiments on cells with broken qubits and without broken qubits, we don't see any additional multibody interactions. So they are coming from something else, probably from the annealing process.
About the same problem. So it looked from your talk that you can actually estimate what the magnetic field is. Yep. When it fluctuates in time, so wouldn't it be relatively simple to test your hypothesis by doing post-selection on your data, selecting on the time-dependent magnetic field and seeing if the couplings actually vanish once you post-select on a given field? Right? Because if you say they arise from fluctuating magnetic fields, once you condition on a given magnetic field...
I mean, so... It depends what you call hypothesis. So, for example, this is not a hypothesis. This is a fact. So, for example, I can just sample from the mixture of these models and give it to you. And if I don't tell you that it's a mixture of the model and I say I guarantee that it's coming from one probability distribution, you will reconstruct this one. And the limit of infinite number of samples, this is exactly the probability distribution you have. So, in some sense, it is kind of... It is in some sense obvious that if you subselect the samples with corresponding to a particular value of magnetic field, you'll just find one model which corresponds to this magnetic field.
Yeah, but there's a chance actually that even when you pulse select on the magnetic field, you will still get three body interactions. Or this, because they arise from a different physical process. Because there's, I agree that this is mathematically equivalent, but you're drawing a conclusion which is causal, right? That a physical fluctuating field is therefore causing this spurious term. But this that's not true, right?
No, this is a very good suggestion. Yeah. So essentially this is essentially this is how you try to test physical hypotheses. Yeah. You should do something like this. Something in favor of this though is that actually we went and presented a preliminary version of this work at the D-Wave headquarters. By the way, that's the first time when I actually saw the D-Wave computer, because at Lionel it's in the restricted area where I never saw our machine. I hope it exists, but I've never seen it. So actually the first time I saw the D-Wave was actually in Burnaby, in Vancouver. And we presented this talk, and essentially folks at D-Wave informally told us that indeed there can be sources of physical noise in the qubits which are related to some electronics purposes. Moreover, we were even had an idea to look at the correlations in these magnetic fields that would indicate that it's indeed the source. And after that, a couple of months after, so they enjoyed the work, and actually a couple of months later, D-Wave released a new generation of the 2000 QU machines, and we have repeated our study, and actually we found that the spurious link were order of magnitude less. And essentially, I'm not giving any official statement, this may be an indication that, for example, the D-Wave essentially found a way to understood that it's important to reduce their noise in the qubit. And because of this fourth power dependence, even reducing it by half leads to a great improvement, essential order of magnitude. So that's why it's very plausible that this is the right assumption. Yeah.
Okay, so thanks Andre again for the talk, and let's close the discussion.
Thank you.
And we reconvene in half an hour roughly for an open problem direction session, whoever is interested.